Welcome to Responsible Management. This is a podcast for the Knowledge Transfer Network community from the University of Bradford School of Management. My name's David Spicer. I'm the school's Director of Business and Community Engagement. I'm delighted to be hosting the podcast again. Today, we're going to be talking about intellectual property for SMEs, and I've got two great contributors with me in the room. Dr. Nuno Ariotta is Assistant Professor in Entrepreneurship and Innovation here in the School of Management. He's got extensive industry experience in operations management and business development and is a serial investor himself. His work has been published in leading journals in the area of entrepreneurship and entrepreneurship education. We're also joined by Anna. Anna Bruin has a background in textile, surface pattern, graphics and corporate design, and she relaunched her business as Amania Design in 2018 as a branded home for her own work and designed work for others. She's learned about intellectual property during her design journey and was encouraged in 2019 to start sharing what she had learned to help others. This grew her intellectual property knowledge, and she now offers training for other designers, creatives, entrepreneurs, schools, colleges, universities, business owners and SMEs on understanding and protecting their intellectual property. Although not legally trained, she works with solicitors to check her content and ensure that that's all legally approved. Anna, Nuno, great to be talking to you.
Great to be here.
Great, thank you.
So we'll start with the question we ask everybody. The podcast is about responsible management. So what does responsible management mean for you, Anna?
Well, I look at responsible management as a holistic thing because I don't think that you can just look at it in one area. I think you should be looking at the money. You should look at ethics. You should be looking at the people, the environment. I think all these things take part in responsible management.
Brilliant. Nuno?
Yeah, I share Anna's perspective, but I tend to be a bit more practical in terms of responsible management. I think the key of being a responsible manager is to look at the fact that we have limited resources on the planet, and if we keep exploring them the way we are, our civilization will end up soon. And the students usually, you know, look at me with a strange face when I say our civilization will end up soon, but that's the fact. So I try to teach them the aspects of it's good to make money, it's good to run a business, it's good to support your family and your community. But it's also good to look at, do we have to do it in the way we are doing it?
Brilliant. So at the risk of making a clumsy link, you talked about finite and threatened resources. We're talking today about intellectual property. I guess that's about partly about protecting resources, isn't it? So have a conversation on what are we talking about? What does IP, intellectual property, mean for businesses?
The definition from the World Intellectual Property Organization, I think that's a good place to start. They describe intellectual property as follows. Intellectual property, known as IP, refers to creations of the mind, such as inventions, literary and artistic works, designs and symbols, names and images used in commerce. IP is protected in law by, for example, patents, copyright and trademarks, which enable people to earn recognition or financial benefit from what they invent or create. By striking the right balance between the interests of innovators and the wider public interest, the IP system aims to foster an environment in which creativity and innovation can flourish. So if you didn't know what IP is, that's the official definition. There you go.
Oh, great. So, from your, I mean, I'm sure you'd recognise that definition, but practically, this is about businesses protecting assets, I guess.
Yeah, it is indeed. I mean, nowadays, with all the social media influences that we live on a daily basis and as part of our lives, it's becoming increasingly more difficult for businesses to protect whatever information they have in many cases, because everything is available online any minute.
That's right.
Anyone can take a photo of something, record something, make public something that should not be made public. And from that moment, it's impossible to protect whatever you want to protect. But regardless of that, of course, I mean, IP is about protecting the intellectual property, whatever that is, that companies develop within doors from that perspective. Yeah.
Well, I can come in back in with the understanding of the IP, because if you think about IP being what starts in somebody's mind as an idea, then whatever comes out from that idea, because you can't protect ideas in the head, it has to be outside the mind. Whether it becomes a piece of music, whether it becomes a design of a mobile phone, a business, training, an invention, a secret, all of those things come under the banner of intellectual property. And if you think about it in that way, whatever is man-made could end up being something that could be protected by intellectual property rights. And in that respect, it just makes it, you realise just how far and wide the whole subject covers. And it's not so dull or uninteresting after all, when you realise actually it impacts people and it impacts me and it impacts you. And we're surrounded by it every day.
it's not that you've thought of it, it's you've thought of it and you've done something with it. It's, it's the output that kind of matters. That's great. Well, I'm going to ask possibly an unfair question, but I'm the host, I get it too. So how does this link back to responsible management? What's the kind of the responsibility angle in terms of IP?
So we live in a world with limited resources, and knowledge, for some reason, became a sort of a commodity. But still, we have to protect that knowledge. I mean, if firms invest in people, right, and people participate in developing new things, new technologies, new products, whatever, there should be a way to protect and to retain that ownership, to protect the investments that firms make in these sort of things. So it's a responsible use of the resources, or it's a responsible way to protect, to some extent, the resources that companies put into creating new processes, new systems, new products, I would say.
And I would say that, you know, you protect and you're responsible for your valuables, whether it's your car or your house, you know, you take care of those things. The intellectual property is something else that's valuable, and it just makes sense to take care of that too.
Yeah, so it's about recognising the asset, isn't it, and the resource that kind of comes with that. And your experience in this, Anna, has come from your own practice as a designer. So perhaps you can tell us a little bit about that journey, as it were, from designer to expert in IP.
Well, it wasn't really planned. So in my journey, I first came across what IP was back in the early 2000s, and I started putting it into action with my own work. I was registering designs, I was using copyright, I was just protecting what I was creating. And in 2018, I registered my first trademark for my business name, which was Amanya. And then I was working with a distributor. We were looking at creating some ranges to sell in the USA, but be produced in China. And I was looking for some business funding for that. Started talking to the Department of International Trade. They said to me, this is when I'd just started to relaunch my business, so I was going in a totally different direction. And they said to me, oh, we can get some funding from the Department of International Trade for building internationally. And I was just like, oh my goodness, I haven't even got my business established, you know, this part of my new business established in the UK yet. But I thought, I'm not going to turn down the opportunity to get some funding. So I put together a business bid. And to much of my great surprise, I ended up getting it. And I had to prove that I was entering into international markets. So I put into the bid some funding for a new website and some funding to get a US trademark and a Chinese trademark. My Chinese trademark failed outright, which was challenging. And then the US one was in danger of failing. And I ended up being recommended somebody, a lawyer in the US, to help resurrect it. And we ended up getting it filed. And it was probably, it was the following year. It was before COVID happened. But somebody said to me, why don't you start sharing with people what you know? And I thought, how hard can it be to share with people my journey? You know, what I've done, I've registered the trademarks and used the copyright and registered designs. So I started putting together, well, I first started asking the designers and artists what subjects was of interest to them. Went through a few things because I kind of sit between the creativity and the business realm. I kind of sit in that middle space and gave them a whole list of topics. And the top of the list came IP. And I thought, well, how hard can it be? So I started putting together a beginner's guide to intellectual property for designers and artists. It wasn't long before I realized I'd taken on a monster, but I just dug my heels in and went, you're not going to beat me. So I just persevered, put together a beginner's guide for the designers and artists community, and then went to the lawyers and said, can you check this? I've been looking at all this information and making sure that, hoping that I was getting it right. And they came back and said, everything's fine, Anna. You know, just add a couple of lines to it. I was flabbergasted. And then it's grown from there. I was getting entrepreneurs and business owners interested in what I was doing. So I adapted the course for them. And then I ended up getting people to ask me to do talks. So I started doing basic talks, introducing people to IP, and then doing workshops, helping people get smart in IP in everyday use. And yeah, it's just grown from there.
Brilliant. So to the practicalities of it, you've talked about trademark, copyright, those presumably the first things we need to consider in terms of protecting assets. There's more than that as well, isn't there? There's patents, there's a whole kind of area, and no lawyers in the room, but I know, Nuno, that's something you've had experience of.
Yeah, I had experience with the IT. The patenting process itself is complicated, but it's something that is doable. But what I wanted to bring here to your attention is the problem of fighting against someone who uses the patent as their patent when actually it's your patent. So that's the problem. So another case which I had, again, another company which I supported, and basically they were in a more like conventional business, fashion jewelry, or patented a specific piece of jewelry that they've, that the drawing was registered as theirs. Okay. So no one could use that kind of drawing in their own manufacturing processes. Yeah. Stuff, yeah. And again, the process that was really straightforward. The problem was what happens now when you see that that drawing is being promoted on Alibaba in China by dozens of other manufacturers that just copied it from the internet and are using it. So my experience with patents and copyrights is obviously they had value, but the problem is when things go wrong, which means that when someone uses them, how to fight against someone who illegally takes ownership of your intellectual property.
That's right.
But it will cost in the region of tens of thousands of pounds to fight in courts.
I'm getting people being sent to me quite often and saying, this has gone wrong, that's gone wrong. And I'm saying, well, I can help you with the training and I can help you with trying to prevent it. But when it gets to this stage, I need to pass you to the lawyers.
Yeah. That's when the money starts. That's when it gets costly.
That's it.
That's the problem.
That's when it gets costly. And at that stage, people are stressed. They are completely frazzled. And it's a very, very difficult situation. The better thing to do is to try and prevent it. And like we say, you can't prevent people from copying. It's just part of life. But if you are smart about your IP and you are active in that, people are less likely to choose your work to copy than somebody else who's not doing anything with their IP.
I was going to ask about what's the business case. I think we're talking about that. It's about protecting your assets. If you've got that protection in place, that will help.
It will help,
but it only helps. You've still got to recognise that that's only going to take you so far. And if you end up in that conversation with somebody who's infringing that, then that's a different position, and kind of alluded already. I mean, there are probably lots of examples out there, aren't they, of direct and indirect infringements. I mean, thinking about, there is a certain high street retailer in the UK that seems to revel in close copies of other people's kind of branded products and does almost does that as part of their marketing effort to kind of...
I don't know how they get away with it. When you go shopping and you go, that looks really, really like... And if you're not careful, you could think it's the original brand. But I don't know how they get away with it, really, because they're so close.
Yeah, I think they've even lent into it kind of a couple of times where they've been challenged by the original owners. And I can think well, we're alluding to Aldi, aren't we? Let's be honest. Well, let's name names. I'll name names. I'll be the guilty party on that front. But there was a beer can that looked very like one produced by BrewDog.
Right.
And when BrewDog challenged it, the actual outcome of that conversation was a partnership where they brought out another kind of beer that was brewed by BrewDog, sold by Aldi, that sort of poked fun at that kind of challenge. I guess that's a creative conversation that comes out of that kind of challenge, but it's rarely the case, I suspect, that's what happens, is it?
Well, I mean, the number of times I'm coming across stories where small businesses are fined, sometimes to the point where they're bankrupt or they have to close the business because they've been challenged by bigger people and they just can't fight back. And that's just a very sad scenario that, you know, that's, I've come across other people that have actually taken on the giants, taken on the big people and won. So, you know, I think it has to start with people understanding the importance of it and going into it with their eyes open, because then at least they're not finding out what intellectual property is when they're in the middle of a fight. It's much better to find out and kind of go, okay, this could happen, that could happen, at least I'm prepared. I think that's a better way to look at the subject and approach the subject.
But I think on a positive note, it's not just bad examples. A patent, if it's granted, can actually add significant value to the company.
Yeah, that's right.
And in some sectors, the value of the company is the value of the patent. Even if they don't have any trade value, if they don't trade or that they don't make a lot of revenue, they can be worth millions of pounds or tens of millions of pounds of that patent. And this is very obvious in sectors like the medical, the life sciences, so the pharmaceuticals and all these sectors, that these drugs, they are all patented. And so obviously in other sectors, there's not quite a correlation. The more traditional sectors, you don't see a correlation between the patents and the value of the business. The value of the business is driven by sales and profits. But in other sectors that are high or very intense in terms of technology and research and development, you do see a correlation between the value of the business and the value of the patents they have. And in some cases, the value of the business is the value of the patents. Without the patents, they are worth almost nothing. So there's all sorts of examples, but extreme where patents are very valuable, and another kind of a point in that continuum where patents are just for the sake of protecting the ownership, but they don't add any value to the business, but still just to give that kind of a note as well. So they are good in the end. It's a good thing to do. It's not something we should not do.
But if we're looking beyond that sector, you know, if we look at brands, you know, we're surrounded by them every day. And the brands that are successful are the ones that have protected their brand names, you know, Coca-Cola, Marmite, Nike. You know, they wouldn't have got where they are if they hadn't protected their brands, because it's part of the value of their companies. So in that respect, a trademark is a really, really valuable thing for a company or a business or an organization to have.
Having that recognition, that registration, that distinctive position that kind of comes with that. And I guess another part of that is that for that to be protectable, it has to be distinctive, doesn't it? So that's where the design comes in, I guess, that you've got to have a brand image that stands out. Otherwise, how do you protect it? Well, you mentioned Nike. We all think of the tick, don't we? Right. You mentioned Marmite, and there's the iconic shape of the jar. I don't know. I assume those are written up into their IP. They're recognised as, so if somebody put another jar of spread on the shelf in a jar that looked like the Marmite jar, Marmite would have an issue with that. I guess where I'm coming from is that part of the conversation with the business as it grows about how it has to develop that distinct identity?
Where do you go for coffee? Costa? Do you go to Starbucks? That's all built on a brand that has got a logo and a distinct feel and ethos around the company. So otherwise you're just going for coffee in a shop. So it's all part of building why people choose you over your competition.
Yeah, that's an important topic, the branding thing around it. I have a story to tell about that. I'm not going to tell what brands do it, but I know that some brands do spend a lot, looking at fashion brands, very high standard brands. You can just figure out two or three on top of your heads. But some of these brands actually used to spend billions a year in enforcement of their brand. Mm-hmm. So they basically had people employed to travel around the world and to identify anyone who was selling their products that were manufactured illegally, of course, anyone that was selling their products that were not manufactured by the main company. And this is one side of the coin. The other side of the coin is that some of these guys from other competitive brands say, we don't really care about it. Let them just make them whatever they want with our brand. We can go to wherever we want in the world. And if we see people using our t-shirts, even though they are not manufactured by our authorized subcontractors, because they look at it as a branding exercise. They say it helps to promote the brand and it costs no money. It's a funny thing, isn't it? So you have two types of policies. Those companies that are very, very absurdly strict on enforcing their rights on the brands. And you have others that say, let them do it. We still sell a lot through our approved channels. And the more people use our logos on their t-shirts, the better, because that's free advertising, whatever that means. It can be actually something that is played in a different way.
But it can backfire on you, that approach. I mean, like in America, Escalator and Hoover both started out as trademarks, but because they didn't enforce the ownership and stop copying and stopped it being used in everyday language, they actually their trademarks were taken away from them. So now we talk about hoovering the floor, don't we?
Yeah.
We don't talk about vacuuming the floor.
No.
And that was a trademark, but it's no longer a trademark. And an escalator is what we talk about, a moving stairway. But that was once a trademark as well. And both of them lost their right to be trademarks because they didn't enforce them properly.
I'm just cutting into the podcast to tell you a little bit about the offer that we have for businesses locally as part of the business and community engagement support. We have our Noise Transfer Network, that's regular networking events where you can come on campus, meet like-minded people, hear from some of our and leading industry experts. We have our Bradford Business Challenge projects, where we have students coming out and working with you and supporting the work that you do. We have our consultancy clinic, where we have students delivering on short-term small projects for businesses as well. There's also lots of ways that you can engage with and interact with our students as guest lecturers, as mentors on some of our entrepreneurship programs, and through involvement in the curriculum. And equally, from a research perspective, we can work with you on collaborative research. If you think there's something we can help with, please reach out to us at BACE, that's base BACE, at bradford.ac.uk. Thank you, and now back to the podcast. I'm now wondering about, you know, we all talk about Googling, don't we? God forbid that Google should.
it'd be interesting to know how that, I've not thought of that one.
Yeah, no, I knew about Hoover. I didn't know about Escalator. I only registered my head that I'd previously been a brand. So that's quite interesting. But it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because there's value in becoming the de facto term that whilst that might undermine your IP, I suspect Hoover are quite like the fact that their brand name, because they're still a business, aren't they, is constantly in people's mouths. Because we talk about Hoover, and similarly, from a Google perspective, we don't, I'm going to go and search on the internet for that. You can say, I'm going to Google it. Yeah, chances are you're probably using Google as well.
That's it.
Because they are so pervasive in that regard. So there's an interesting tension between protection and the value that comes from getting a brand out there. So I guess that's the kind of thing that leaders in organizations need to be kind of thinking about when they're managing their IP. What are the kind of good practices that we should be following in this regard?
Well, you mean advising the leaders, the business owners? Yeah. I think it's very important that every business owner understands what is IP-able, what you can protect, so to speak. Yeah. Came up with a new word. If you want to give me some patent, I can get a patent on that. I can get a patent on that. What you can actually do to protect and what things you can protect. This should be something that every business owner should be mindful of, that the same way they can read a balance sheet or a profit and loss statement, even in basic terms, and the same way they understand marketing, even if it is in basic terms, they should understand from everything they do what can be and what can be not protected. That's something and that information doesn't pass to the businesses. They frequently assume that only things that are based on intense research and development, only those guys that work in labs, they can actually create something that is patentable, which is not right. Anyone can create something that is to some extent protected. So that's something that I would encourage people to learn the basics of it. And then from there, obviously, there are things that are worth it, things that are not worth it. It's always a cost and benefit. Is it worth spending £50 on registering the brand of the company? Probably it is. But if you register the brand of the company, it will not protect you from someone registering a website with that brand. You just have the brand, but you may not have the website with your brand in the name of the website. So you need to think, okay, I need to protect the brand, but that doesn't give me access to having a .com after my brand. So you still need to look at, can I protect that? Well, for that, you need to register it before someone else does. Because otherwise, someone else will probably register it. And when your brand is worth some money, they will try to sell it to you.
That's right.
It's a problem.
You reminded me of two examples. So there was the guy who famously registered 21st Century Fox, thinking that 20th Century Fox would then have to throw him a load of money when the century changed. They just ignored it and stuck with the existing name on the kind of the back of that. But the other one is when we have student entrepreneurs pitching businesses, and a lot of the time, and the first thing I do when they're pitching is I Google. I'm not going to be self-conscious every time I say that. The business name. And it's amazing that they've not thought about that. Mm-hmm. Who's using that name? And I know they're very early stage thinking about businesses. But it's important.
I mean, we're in Bradford for this podcast, and just down the road in Brighouse, you may be aware of the Ritz Ballroom. It was an entertainment venue that opened up in 1937, and they were busy trading. They were busy, entertaining people, ballroom stuff, people coming in to do shows and bands and stuff. In the year 2017, they had an email from some lawyers in London that represented the Ritz hotel chain, saying to them, you can no longer use the name Ritz in your name because you're infringing our intellectual property. And they had about 3 days, I think, to decide what they were going to do, whether they were going to go ahead and fight the case or they were going to change the name. And they thought, we don't actually have the money. We've got no guarantee that we can win this. And they decided to change the name. So they changed it to Venue 73. But if you think about the implications of that, they had to start from scratch with marketing. They couldn't use any hashtags they'd used before. They couldn't use any publicity they had before. They were really starting from the bottom up. And that was difficult for them. And then come another couple of years, COVID hits, and it's the final nail in the coffin. And that venue is now closed, even though it had been trading for over 80 years. And that's one of the implications if you don't think about the longer term thing. And they were a small little venue, but the internet meant that they were found out.
I'm probably going to make a critical point I shouldn't make, but hey, I'm going to make it anyway. For me, there's a responsible management thing here about how companies view their IP. So with the greatest respect to the Ritz Hotel, I'm fairly confident there is nobody on this planet that's going to confuse them and the Ritz Ballroom in Brickhouse.
You would have thought so, wouldn't you?
That feels like that. That's not an infringement. That's not an issue. You know. So what?
Why would you want to do it?
Yeah. It's that almost that wrong attitude to protection, isn't it? It's the name at all costs. Not are we being overcome or issued? I guess that's about how we engage with others in that kind of sort of protected space, isn't it? As appropriate behaviours and not that I'm saying behaviour wasn't appropriate, that they have every right to protect their kind of brand position. But you sometimes feel like maybe if there'd been a dialogue there, you could have got a different outcome. I guess that's, you're back to our primary audience being SMEs. Mm-hmm. That's the challenge for an SME facing that kind of pressure, isn't it? It's how do you respond? And there's no easy answer to that.
Yeah, I agree. You should not be that extreme. You can, but as a responsible manager, you would need to ponder the consequences of what you do. And of course, if I were the manager of a Ritz, I would say, why would I bother with some guys in Bradford that have a saloon that is called Ritz? I mean, it will not affect my business. I will not get more customers or less customers. From a responsible management perspective, it's a bad practice because they protected the brand, but they probably destroyed the lives of, or at least the jobs of a fairly amount of people. And that's not being very responsible, is it? And this is valid for big companies or small companies. You need to look at it. What are the It's the cost-benefit analysis always. Mm.
And I also think from a, you know, we're living in a world where the internet is at our fingertips all the time. So, you know, whether you're a local business or you're an international business, you can be found if you've got something on the internet. So if you're starting up a business, if you're starting up an SME, do your due diligence about the name you've chosen, who your competition is, whether you're likely to be infringing what they're doing, because right now, when you might be small, further down the line, when you're a bit bigger, you might end up having to rebrand. So it's kind of thinking about this when you're small, because it's important.
So that brings me to my kind of next question about practical advice and the kind of things that the businesses need to be thinking about in this regard. So start early, check, you know, get the protection in place, and then make sure you're not infringing anybody else's, because you're hopefully then not going to have issues further down the line. Is there anything else you would want to recommend?
Be sure that there is always a geographic limitation in terms of the protection that you get, right? If you get a brand registered in the UK, it doesn't automatically entitle you to get that brand in the United States. So look at whether or not there are agreements between the governing bodies in different countries on and how they cooperate, because it's relatively easy to enforce that if there is a network of countries that cooperate in that kind of legal aspect of enforcing the IP. But if you try to enforce a brand between, for example, extreme example, the UK and Russia now, it's obviously not possible. Or even China, even though China is moving towards a proximity with the Western world in terms of those kind of regulations. But that's important for a company that aspires to grow, or a company that, even though they don't aspire to grow, they aspire to become international, because it could be that at some point there will be a conflict. Another company that operates in your target market that, by the way, has the same brand that you have, and then that's a problem. How are we going to change that? You need to do a bit of research on, and also need to look at the categories, because sometimes when you register a brand, you assign that brand to a specific category of products.
That's right.
So it means I can have a shoe brand called whatever, and then I can also register a cutlery brand with the same name. And if I am a cutlery owner, I cannot claim the shoe brand as using my brand, and vice versa, because they are registered in different categories, right? So that's a problem again. So you, in some cases, it can create very comic, funny situations, right? Where your brand is known in a different country, but not because you manufacture shoes, but because you manufacture.
Well, giving an example of that, Polo is registered in different categories. So you've got Polo the sweets, they're registered. You've got Polo the car brand, that's registered. And you've got Polo from Ralph Lauren, registered.
All right.
But none of them are in conflict with each other because in totally different segments. So it's exactly what you're saying. They've all been able to register the same name, but because they're not conflicting with each
other. Until the moment that Volkswagen decides to go into the fashion.
Yes.
Or vice versa. That's going to be a problem.
Yeah. Not at this stage.
I'm now wondering if VW decided to produce T-shirts with the Polo branding on, I think we'd still be okay, wouldn't we? I think we'd still be okay. It points to the complexity of what is quite a simple idea. In practice, making this work right for a business is obviously quite a challenge. So I guess we've touched on this already, but in terms of getting advice, guidance on managing IP, obviously that's something you do, Anna, but where else can we go?
Yeah, well, there are centres. There's one in Leeds, the BIPC, I think it's called, centre in Leeds that lawyers go and give advice to small companies and stuff. You can go there. You can speak to the intellectual property office. There's a lot of people that will pick up the phone and answer your questions. You won't be speaking necessarily to the lawyers, but you can get some practical advice from them. And just don't think it's not important, because it is.
Well, I think you can Google.
you can Google. Yeah.
But then I touched the main points. The IP office in the UK, they do have a good support in terms of consultation, and you don't have to pay for it to get your initial trial process of what you should do, what you can do, what you cannot do. Talk to other business people who have or are in the same line of business as you are, and try to explore with them whether they did it and was it worth it or not. So try to do some research in your own network. It's always a good idea to learn from people that are sharing the same common interests, and probably they will tell you things that, well, officially the IP officers cannot tell you or would not tell you, and they will give you that kind of practical advice. Yeah, do this, do that, don't do this, don't do that. Yeah, I mean, it's not a matter of this knowledge is available. Is just that is the last thing that business people think about when they woke up in the morning, right? Mm-hmm. And sometimes the whole year goes by and they never thought about it until it's too late. It's one of those things that we need to bring to the top of the mind of business owners, the same way they think about marketing, sales, recruiting people, retaining customer loyalty and all that. They still need to think a bit about, am I not doing something that I was supposed to be doing?
Yeah.
Just raise that awareness, which is what we are doing here also, is important, I would say.
Yeah. I would agree with you, Nuno. I'd say, as a business owner, you are putting together your business strategy, your business plan. IP needs to be part of that. It's very difficult because it's very intangible. You can't necessarily put exact figures on what you're doing, but it needs to become part of your planning, your future planning, as you would do with your business strategy. I put IP as part of that section.
I have a provocative thought, which is a bit... moving forward, maybe what we are saying now in 10 years from now is going to be totally irrelevant, because there are obviously the number of content that is produced daily on the internet is increasing so much that at some point it will be impossible to track and to monitor everything that's being produced, right? And other thing that's emerging now is the AI. AI creates stuff, content, which some of which could be protected. Who's going to protect content that has been already published by an AI agent who no one controls? I mean, this is also, this is a bit far-fetched, but looking in the next 10 years, where will we be in terms of the protection of things that nowadays we still think it's worth protecting? Maybe 10 years from now, we'll just say, you know what, skip it. Not sure.
No, it's a callback in many respects. We discussed AI and its impact on business a couple of podcasts ago, and if you listen to back to that one, there's even AI Me speaking on that. And I've been seeing adverts. It's December when we're recording this. You know, you can get a book written by a relative, generated by AI, as a gift to give that person. That opens up a whole realm of kind of questions around copyright and the origination of ideas. If you generate something based on content previously produced by one person through AI, I feel like we might need another session to bottom that one.
It's a huge subject, because the law hasn't caught up with what's happening out in the world. I mean, I'm amazed that AI could have been developed this far without them seeing this could have been a problem. Did they just kind of go into it blind, going, we're going to just wing it? Because it's, you know, they're picking up information from all over the internet that's belonging to people and should be protected by IP. And they're like, oh, we'll just use it. And it's a legal minefield.
And we're still developing that understanding, aren't we? That's the kind of the challenge. It's been a really stimulating conversation, guys. I've really, really enjoyed the conversation. Final question. We've asked all of our contributors over the series this. Who's your management hero? That can be personal or professional. It can be somebody that you've read or you've worked with. The person who's inspired or kind of influenced you over your career. So, Nuno.
In my case, it's Peter Drucker. He's a famous ex-guru of management. Basically, he said something, I don't know how many years ago, but... he basically said, the only skill that you need in life is to continue to learn new skills, which is what I say to my students all the time. Everything that we tell you now, it's probably becoming irrelevant in 5 years. So the only thing you need to know is how to learn new things that will become relevant. That's what I follow.
I've got a collection of Drucker original books, very thumb. They're originally owned by my dad.
Whoa.
Brilliant. I love it. Anna.
Well, you asked me this question before we did the podcast, and I thought about it. And I thought, actually, my mum and my dad have been some of the two most influential people for me on a business level and how that's embedded in my life as well. My dad left a very secure career in ICI the year I was born to do some research that could or could not lead to something. On the back of that, they built a company that is still trading today. But the risk they took to take the leap, mum and dad had a small family. They took the leap and it was a challenge. And especially as the business went through its teething problems and went through a number of years where it wasn't really becoming clear exactly what was happening. But I remember in my teens, my dad got approached by, I think it was Ford at first, a company that was working with Ford, because they were looking to get, he was an engineer, my dad, and they'd created very specialized powdered steel. And this steel was being used in valve seats that they were trialing with the lead-free petrol cars. And at the time, everybody was still driving with leaded petrol. And so Ford took this up and then Mitsubishi took it up. And the business was totally, you know, went to a whole different direction. But they've been my business mentor. They've been my help over many, many years. And a number of times I've said, what do we do about this? Or even when I ended up taking the leap from leaving a part-time job to doing my business full-time, because that when I got that funding, that was an opportunity that arose for me. My dad said to me, don't be surprised. It takes longer than you think. And he asked me how much money I had in the bank. So, you know, practical things. So they've been a huge influence on me.
Great. That's brilliant. I love that question because you get such a range of kind of insights and answers. It's brilliant. So thank you both very much for sharing. Thank you for the conversation as well. If people would like to know more, want to reach out, contact you, how best can they do that? So Nuno?
n.arroteia@bradford.ac.uk.
Check the show notes for the spelling, perhaps. But we're all fairly easily findable on the web as well.
Or just email David, it's easier to find me.
Yeah.
Anna?
Well, probably the easiest place to go is to go to my website, which is www.amanya, which is spelt like Amanda with a Y, amanyaipcourses.com. That's probably the best place to find the IP stuff that I do.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, both. If you want to reach out to us here at the School of Management, it's at Dave P. Spice, at Brad Management, if you're still on that particular platform. We have a generic email, bacebase@bradford.ac.uk, for all matters business and community engagement, or you can find us on the web. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please like and subscribe. We do love a 5-star review. Thank you very much, both of you, and we'll see you next time.
If you've got a project that you'd love to get done, but you're struggling with the time and resources to do that, that's something that we can help you with. Bradford Business Challenge projects are where we get our students to do, as part of their dissertation, a piece of applied management work for a business like yourselves. Either one of our final year undergraduate or MSc students, with the support of an academic mentor, will be able to work on that project for you. There's no cost for you as a business. All we ask for you is to set up with us that project, give us a kind of outline brief that the student will go away and work into a full proposal for you, and then you'll be meeting and liaising with them and their academic advisor to get that project delivered. Because we have multiple students doing these over the course of the year, there's usually a group of students looking for any project at one time. So if that's something that you're interested in and you'd like to know more about, please reach out to us at bacebase@bradford.ac.uk.